Hi everyone, I'm Mark Esper. Welcome to the No Spoiler Reviews podcast, where today I'm going to be interviewing writer, director and producer Jeffrey Morris, whose titles Parallel Man and Oceanus are set to appear on the sci-fi distribution channel Dust. Hi Jeffrey.
Hello.
So tell me, how did you get into filmmaking?
You know, it's interesting. I actually, I got into filmmaking because I wanted to be an astronaut.
Wow.
As a child, I was a huge space enthusiast, and you know, we were still going to the moon when I was very small, and I was really enthusiastic about it all. I wanted to go to the moon, you know, and I watched movies like 2001: A Space Odyssey, and you know, TV shows like Space 1999 that had a moon base, and I kept thinking, oh my gosh, you know, in the year 2000, I'll be able to be there and part of all this, and it's going to be amazing. And for some reason, I kind of sensed that the world wasn't going in that direction. In terms of what I saw in the movies and the TV shows that I really dreamt, you know, those dreams didn't seem to be coming to pass. So I saw Star Wars like a lot of kids did. I think it was like fifth grade or something like that. And while my friends were really into the action figures and all the you know the other stuff, I was like, how did they make that film? And the reason why I wanted to know was because I was like, what if we used that technology and those capabilities creatively to tell stories about a base on Mars or living on the moon or traveling through the solar system, you know, going to the moons of Jupiter, places like that. And so I decided to become a filmmaker to create the kind of visions that I wanted to see, you know, the reality that I wanted to see, to try to exemplify the reality I wanted to live in. And so, you know, I also was a big into oceanography and that sort of thing too, which is part of the impetus for creating some of the underwater projects I have and things like that. So, yeah.
Wow. So how do you think in terms of universes when you're kind of formulating your characters and stories?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've always been into the concept of world building. You know, I was a big fan of Arthur C. Clarke and Larry Niven and authors like that. You know, in my formative years, and the kind of worlds that they would these sort of Larry Niven had this known universe series, and I really got into how he built that and how the characters would cross connect and the species and all the you know the worlds and that sort of thing. You know, the original Star Trek, watching that show and how you're kind of just dumped into it. It's not like the original Star Trek begins and then you know, you know what I mean? It's there. Sure. And it's this lived in world that has its, nomenclature and has its, operational, structure and function to it. Right. So seeing all that, it's something I really took stock of. And I think that was a big part of the foundation of my interest in building my own worlds, you know, and really, you know, everything from the graphics, you know, the interfaces, the, you know, the how and the why do things work the way they do? How do they work the way they do? That sort of thing. I've always found it really fascinating when worlds are thoroughly fleshed out and built well, you know? Mm-hmm. So. So I think that's part of it for me, you know?
So you're clearly thinking about stories like on a broad, grand scale.
Yes.
Things like Asimov's Foundation and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with the stories for Parallel Man and Oceanus? And more importantly, given the fact that these are huge tales, how did you shrink them down into an elevator pitch?
Yeah, you know, thanks for that. That's a great question. You know, well, let's see. First off, I always look at it. I think in my mind, the whole world is there. Right. And so then what you do, so if you imagine you've got this, this expansive vision in your head, and what you're able to do is give a snapshot of that vision. You have to be able to bring it down to a snapshot. So to me, with Oceanus, it's like, okay, how do I, there's so many different aspects. You go, well, what's my budget? How much money do I have to work with if I'm going to make a film like this? So I settled on, okay, I'm going to tell a story with just a small number of characters in a very limited number of sets, but try to tell a big story that's set within that small, those parameters, right? And then what I did is when you watch the short, you can see that from the icons and logos, and there's so many things I did to try to make you feel like, wow, there's a much bigger world than what I'm seeing mm-hmm. in this little submarine, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is that from everything from how their name tags work to their, you know, the seeing the icon for the base on different things, you know, seeing the computer graphics showing the different vehicles and vessels and all those things, that's where the way that you get a glimpse into the outer world, if that makes sense, right? So if you're a viewer, you may just focus solely on the actors and the story that's being told. But I think that for people like yourself and myself, I, you know, when I want to look at that broader world, I'm looking around and I'm seeing all that lived in aspect, right? The lived in aspect of it that brings it bigger. You know, with Parallel Man, it was a story where we're trying to, again, we only had a few minutes. We wanted to make that, you know, 15 minutes or less, the short, but I wanted to create something that was a propulsive journey that gives you a sense of how this world works, the dynamic energy of it, but also be able to give you pauses where the characters could help give context to it. So the very beginning of the short to the very end of it, that there's enough there to kind of get it brackets it with the narrative. So you can really understand, okay, there's something bigger going on. There's this world, the ascendancy, there are these, we're conquering parallel worlds. This guy's obviously being chased by a totalitarian regime that he actually himself works for, all those sorts of things. So that was a way to give a snapshot of this much bigger picture, and it actually is an excerpt of the comic book itself. So that there's the first issue of the comic book series. We kind of took the first 10, 15 pages of it and turned it into this animated bit as well. So they kind of talk to each other, which is
got cool. It. So quite often in sci-fi, things go wrong by their very nature. Mm-hmm. Either people bump into hostile aliens or fool around with time travel and so on. Mm-hmm. Is disaster like somehow a prerequisite for good sci-fi drama, or are there kind of other tales that can be told?
Okay, you asked the question, so I'm going to be honest.
Why not?
Yeah, I'll be honest. Here's the thing. I'm going to go deep on this one. For me personally, I would be very happy to see a story just about we're living on Mars, and Mars is constantly trying to kill us, right? Okay, from a science standpoint, when you have an atmosphere that's less than 1% the density of ours on Earth, and you have no, you know, the magnetic field to protect you from radiation, and it's, 75 below zero, and it's, you know, all, you know, and, right? I mean, there's so many things. I could just go on and on and on and on with all the things that you have to deal with. It's like we see these pretty pictures. I'm going to use Mars as an example. You sure. See pretty pictures of Mars that are taken by these landers and rovers, and you go, wow, that looks like the desert. Looks like this nice desert. And look, there's an atmosphere, and the sun's there in the sky, and every once in a while you can see little cirrus clouds, and well, it's kind of like Earth. It's really not like Earth at all. And it's a horrific and tremendously dangerous place. And I think we're going to find that when we attempt to colonize it, there are going to be people who are going to die. And it's going to be very, very difficult to do. Maybe even so difficult that we aren't going to be able to pull it off, right?
Yeah.
And to me, that is a story in and of itself. I could watch the heck out of that, right?
Yeah.
You know, as a movie or a TV show or a novel. The problem is, what I just said to you, you have to have all the context for it, right? You know, from a science standpoint, you have to know all that contextually going into it, right? To fight against what your eyes are telling you is, well, that's just a desert. That looks like Morocco, you know, right? It looks like, right?
Sure.
And so I think that what these disasters do is they tend to give us a simple way to get the audience into the drama and into the situation, right? So in other words, you say, we're going to do a story about this thing that happens on Mars, and there's an explosion in the colony, and they have to deal with this, and there's a disaster, and they have to, and instead the story I just told you about trying to survive this ecological thing, that's a slow burn. I think Hollywood would have a lot of trouble figuring out how to tell that story, if that makes sense, right? And especially with attention span shortening the way they are nowadays, right? We live in a world where you have to have a trailer before a movie trailer, right? Okay. You know, so it's a very different thing. So when I was confronted with doing Oceanus, the issue that I had to look at was, I really wanted to just do a story about people living in an underwater city. I'd love to just do that story. I think, because I think that would be hard enough. I think there's enough drama in that, right? But the problem was I kept going, well, why would you build an underwater city? And how does it become important? And who would build it and why? And all these things, you know, and then how can I make this really, really resonate with an audience where they really care, this audience nowadays? So what is happening in the short film is there is a disaster that befalls the Earth. You don't find out what that disaster is in the short, but in the full feature film, you will.
Right.
And that disaster makes that underwater city not just it's beyond just being an important place of science and exploration. It becomes a key to survival of the human species, this underwater city. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you see what I'm saying? So in this case, the disaster gives me a context for a greater hero's journey.
Got it. So in the terms of casting your characters to explore the realms that you're describing, it always seems to be like there is a mixture of scientists and adventurers. In terms of vessels for your stories, are you more pulled towards the adventurer or the scientist?
You know, what's interesting is I actually turn my scientists into adventurers.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I really like this. I like what you're saying, because I realize you're right. There is sort of a delineation between the two typically. But I honestly, what I'm doing with my stories is I'm taking the science people and I'm turning them into the adventurers, or I'm certainly putting them in the same mix. Like my feature film that I'm working on, Persephone, is about a colony that's being set up on Proxima B, the orbiting the nearest star. And the idea there is that, you know, it's taken 50 years to get there. You have some people that were in hibernation. Some of the people were awake during the journey. And what I wanted to do was create this sort of intergenerational conflict between a character who was born on Earth versus a character who was born on the spaceship.
Sure.
Right. And so then they both are confronting an ecological situation when they arrive at the planet that was unexpected. And so each one has a very, very different reaction to how to deal with the problem, with the situation, because the one who was born on the ship has only had in mind the mission of living on this planet. And so, and then the other person's like, well, yes, I'm coming from a species that was on the verge of extinction that's coming to live on a new planet. And I don't want to bring those mistakes to the new planet. So those two people have this incredible conflict that happens because of this. And that's really the basis of my feature that I'm working on, Persephone. So so the point is they are in combination and they have to go on the scientist and engineer is with the adventurer astronaut. Mm-hmm. And they have to go on the adventure together and they react to it differently. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. So you're creating the story and you're, as I understand it, using different genres, different formats with which to sort of explore the universes that you're creating. Mm-hmm. How do you make the decision that, okay, this is something that needs to be realized as a televisual or a cinematic piece?
Oh, sure.
And how do I, and this is the comic book or this is the graphic novel or this is the audio play, or how do you break them apart?
Yeah. No, it's interesting because it's at the core of my work. I have people ask me quite often, like, what do you do? How do you get there? It must be a lot of fun what you're doing. And I say, you know, actually 85% of my work is the economics of it, the financing of it, and being an entrepreneur and running the business side of this. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is that's really the key in a lot of ways in terms of deciding what's best for an intellectual property, the direction. I look at the economics of it and I look at what's the potential audience, what's the potential revenue streams, what are the, you know, potential distribution, those sorts of things. With something like Parallel Man, we're dealing with a concept with where you're skipping through the multiverse, right? And to do that realistically and believably as a live action movie, you're talking probably in the neighborhood of $100 to $200 million for a budget for a 2-hour movie like that, to do it realistically in a photoreal, you know, fashion. When it comes to a television series, right, you would probably be looking at for 10 episodes, upwards of at least $100 million to do that. With animation, we could do it things that are just as big or bigger in scope, because you have less limitations when you're doing animation in terms of, you know, right, you're still dealing with the reality of trying to place the characters, at least I would, in the physics of the physics of the situation. You want it to still be rooted and believable and that sort of thing. And so, you know, to make it look real, it's expensive. With animation, we can make it even bigger and do it for a fraction of the cost.
Right.
So that's right. So that's why I chose Parallel Man as animation instead of live action, you know, because I felt that it was better served as a story to do it that way. Other things that I do, I look at it and I say, you know, this is a story that needs to spread out. I need more time with it. So a TV show, pitching it as a 10 episode TV show would give me more time to flesh out the characters and the dynamic, and maybe the character arcs that I would do in a three act movie structure. You spread those three acts across the 10 episodes,
sure.
Right? So you're doing 10 three act stories, you know, individual three act stories in a big three act arc, mm-hmm. of the whole thing. So, and then other things that to me, it's just designed specifically to be a live action feature film, you know, the movies I'm making are one, I don't really want huge budgets for my films because I think that, we're doing what are called mid-range budget movies, I think that first off, that lets me have more of the cast that I want. There's an economic thing there because the bigger the budget, the bigger the stars. And there's a very limited number of stars that can drive a $100 to $200 million film. That's why we see the same actors in all these movies over and over again. I want a broader range of diversity of actors, diversity of ages. One of Persephone, I'm trying to pursue a lead actress who's more in her 60s or even 70s, right? If I'm making $100 plus million film, they don't want to do that. It's like, you know, having a female lead, even a female lead is difficult.
I think there's a lady available from The Expanse, provided you let her swear a lot. I think she'd be up for it.
You know, she's wonderful. She's absolutely wonderful. Boy, The Expanse is, I could talk, I could do a whole show with you on The Expanse. I love that.
I love it.
It's great. It's awesome. So, yeah. Did I answer your question? Did that?
Yes, by means. Okay, by means. Because I was going to come on and ask about casting. How did you manage to gather in the talents of people like The Mandalorians, Ming-Na Wen, and also A Clockwork Orange's iconic Malcolm McDowell? And more importantly, also, how was it to work with them?
I have to tell you that conceptually I was intimidated going in. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like Malcolm McDowell. You know, I love Malcolm McDowell. I mean, I think about all the films that I've seen him in and everything, but he came in and we just talked and we got along, and what he wanted more than anything was for me to tell him what I needed for my project. So I directed him. I had to just let go of any fear I had and just go, hey, this is another human being. We have a job to do, you know, get rid of the fact that it's this iconic actor who's played all these iconic characters and just do your job. And it worked out. And I remember when it was over, he said something like, well, he knew what he wanted. And that made me very happy.
That was the biggest compliment
he could have given me. He's like, yeah, exactly. He said that. And, you know, with Ming, I think with all these people, everyone liked the scripts. That's the one thing. Mm-hmm. They get, you know, if they didn't like the scripts, they wouldn't touch it. So we had to get the scripts in front of them first. They looked at it. And then they had to see my vision. And I do a lot of concept art and design work. And you know that I can share with my teams before so they can see that, like, we're not going to waste your time. We've got something that's for real. We've got something that's high quality. I don't do things unless they're top notch. So with everyone we pitched, they looked at it and said, okay, this is going to be good. This isn't going to be junk. This is worth my time.
Yeah.
And I don't want my name on junk. So, you know, so that was helpful. So, with Ming, again, we just got along great. It was just a really fun, actually, I would say she was the most fun to work with. We laughed a lot and had a lot of fun with the character and, made up some things and changed some things right there on this, you know, we had previs, but I gave her room to kind of play with it, and we worked with it together at the time. And so, and she was really, it was really exciting because she gave me one of the biggest compliments I had. Another compliment, which was she felt that we were better prepared visually than the team she worked with when she did Mulan with Disney. So that was really cool. So she, you know, cause I had it all kind of set up and I was like, this is what we're going to do. This is what it looks like. And I, you know, we'd already done previs and put temp voices in and the whole thing. So she was able to see what was going on. So it was an honor for me to be able to work with people like them and John Cho and Lance Reddick. You know, and we actually, my feature Persephone, we've got some big name A-list actors that are coming to that. I'll be able to announce that fairly soon too. So it's cool. Pretty cool. So yeah. And I think the key is just high quality content and a clarity of vision and, and a confidence that I know what I'm doing. So these people can see that I'm not going to waste their time. You know, I mean, I think the worst thing you can say to an actor or a crew is, I don't know, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I think that's not what they want to hear, you know, and nor, sure. nor do I think they want to work with evil dictators either. Right. It's like, it is a collaboration. It is a chance to be artistic and create together. Right. But at the end of the day, it is my vision. So they're like, well, what do you want? What do you want?
Sure.
And I got to tell them what I want and I have to show them what I want and we get it done.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So how did you land the deal with Dust?
Well, I actually, let's see, one of my colleagues who I worked with on Oceanus, a gentleman named Eli Sasich, he actually did a wonderful miniseries called Atropa that aired on Dust. And he worked with me on as a producer and a collaborator on Oceanus and some other projects we're developing together. He's actually based out of Salt Lake City, and we're actually shooting a bunch of our films at Park City Studios and working with him and everything. And I said, man, how did you, this Dust is awesome. Like, you know, can you hook me up? And Eli put me in touch with them and we got the shorts over to them and they really liked them. And they were like, let's do this. You know, so that's kind of, it's kind of how we did it. So I mean, a lot of this stuff is done. I've been learning over the years that it's who, you know, it's having the right relationships and being in the right place at the right time. And being ready to move when the opportunity is there. And it's not, it's never, it doesn't work by some sort of, I'm going to submit this and then it's going to go through the process and then we're going to do it. It just doesn't seem to work that way. It's I know somebody who knew somebody. And well, that's why we have so much, I think, poor content, right? Because it's not really being made based upon some sort of an ethic or a process. It's more like, well, yeah, my cousin's got this movie. We should do that. You know, it's a very interesting industry, very interesting. So, but if you can be in the right place at the right time and build the right relationships, I think you can get some inroads and get some things going. And we're finally getting there, which is great. Yeah.
Excellent. And lastly, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received? And what advice would you give to any other future world builders out there?
I think the best piece of advice I've ever received, number one piece is, if you give up, it will never happen. So in other words, no matter how fatigued you get, no matter how much the challenge seems to be insurmountable, you have a responsibility to yourself and your vision to follow through. And even if that means that it has to be put on the back burner, it's still on a burner.
Yeah.
You know, even if it means it has to go to the back of the bus, it's still in the back of the bus. You have to keep it moving. You have to, you can never give up, because literally if you give up, it won't happen. Right.
Right.
And so to me, it's like the law of averages, right? The longer you stay in the game, the closer you get to success. And so I think that's the key that I would say to anybody who has a world that they want to build or something they want to do. It's like, you know, first off, make sure that that you've really thought it through and you're actually creating something of quality, and surround yourself with people who can push you to create your best, not just people who agree with you, not just people who are like, oh, that's really cute. You know, you're going to find people who are like, can poke holes in your vision and who will challenge you on and make you better than you know, what you were. So, being that last guy in the room, you're still in the room, you know, that's
right.
The thing, right? Right. So that would be the number one piece of advice I would give. Really, really think about, I look at the real world, right? And I think about the depth and the breadth of the real world. And then I go, okay, if I'm going to make a world, how do I make a world that has the same sort of depth and breadth, while realizing that I can only give a sliver of that. I can't, in any story I tell, I can't, obviously our world is, it's enormous, right? So how do you, so we're telling stories that are little slivers of these worlds. Just because it's this big world in your mind, you still have to have the big world in your mind in order to have a very powerful sliver.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for coming on the show and sharing your stories with us. And I wish you all the very best and all success for 2022.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking with you today.
Likewise. So there you have it. I hope you like what you heard. And if you fancy having some more No Spoiler interviews delivered to your favorite listening device, then please consider subscribing. So if that's your kind of thing and you don't like knowing the ending before you start, then I look forward to you joining us for even more interviews and reviews.